Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. June is Immigrant Heritage Month, and we are celebrating all month long by sharing past programs presented in conjunction with our special exhibit, My America, Immigrant and Refugee Writers Today. This exhibit has been extended through 2021, and you can explore it in person at the American Writers Museum or online at my-america.org. This week, Program Director Allison Sansoni chats with writer and professor Aaron Bobro Strain, whose book, The Death and Life of Ida Hernandez, tells the true story of a Mexican teen mother journeying through the U.S. immigration system and the obstacles she faces. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
This is the fourth of our virtual events in the Jean and John Rowe series, My America, Immigrant and Refugee Writers Today. This series accompanies the exhibit of the same name that opened at our Chicago Museum in November and opened online as well at my-america.org. And at that site right now, you can see stories from writers from 18 different countries talking about family, connection, influence, and what it means to them to write as an American. So my name is Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here at the American Writers Museum. We're grateful to all of you for being here and for valuing the present, past, and future of American writing. Our guest for conversation tonight is Aaron Bobro Strain. He's a professor of politics at Whitman College, where he teaches courses dealing with food, immigration, and the U.S.-Mexico border. In the 1990s, he worked on the border as an activist and educator. He's a founding member of the Walla Walla Immigrant Rights Coalition in Washington State. His most recent work, The Death and Life of Ida Hernandez, tells the true story of a Mexican teen mother journeying through the U.S. immigration system and the obstacles she faces there. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you, Allison. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm eager to talk to you about the book. I just finished it myself. And so, you know, when we first meet Ida, you know, she's on the brink of death from a vicious attack, and the story moves, you know, backward from there. What was your first meeting with Ida, and what did you find compelling enough about her story to decide to make it a book?
Yeah, sure. So I'd had a long connection with the U.S.-Mexico border. I had worked there. At a certain point, after doing work in writing about Mexico and other contexts, I really wanted to be back on the border, just because one thing that falls out of the news a lot, especially when it's focused on border crises, is just there's a beauty and a richness to life in the borderlands. Folks who are living their lives across borders and cultures and languages, and I just wanted to be in that place. At the same time, I knew that the borderlands have, for the past almost 30 years now, been set up as a sacrifice zone to our worst national fears and instincts. And so I really wanted to go to the border and try to understand how people were living their lives amidst that contradiction. And so early on in the process, a woman named Rosy Mendoza became one of my key guides to Douglas. And Rosy, probably someone in the audience has met her. Everywhere I go in the country, I meet people who have met her and just been just blown away by her. And she is a badass, formerly undocumented social worker who works with people going through domestic and sexual violence on the border. And she became one of my key guides to Douglas, Arizona. And she eventually said, you know, over breakfast one day, actually, she said, there's this young woman, a client of mine, who eventually became a friend. And I can't tell you anything about her story for privacy's sake, but I'm going to tell her about your work. And if she wants to call you, she will. And if she calls you, you should talk to her. And so it took a while for us to finally meet. But to kind of cut it short, we met in the 10th Street Park in Douglas on a wintry day, and we sat next to the fountain, and Ida told me her story, and yeah, I had not at all planned to write a book, and much less to put violence against women at the heart of a border book, but after talking with Ida that day, I realized that she had such a powerful message for those of us who look at the border from a relatively privileged position, and that you cannot understand what's happening on the U.S.-Mexico border. We cannot understand the U.S.-Mexico border that the rest of us have created without separate from the way our approach to border security makes women's lives less secure on the border. So, you know, and from there, that was our first meeting, and Ida told me her life story, not the whole story, part of it. And from there, the hard work began of talking about whether and how to write a book, and then really diving into what would become a 4-year collaboration on writing this book.
What comes through very clearly in the book is the way that the system works against immigrants, both documented and undocumented, in a way that it doesn't against more privileged people. Tell us about some of the pitfalls that Ida encountered that someone with, say, more money or more legal savvy or more familiarity with, you know, with the immigration system, say, wouldn't have faced.
Sure. I mean, and it's not even just the immigration system. It's the experience of life in general is that, you know, she is an active member and a maker of her community. She's fully a part of this community, and yet she's denied real legal membership in the community, and she's cut off from the kinds of rights and opportunities that a lot of people would have growing up, whether that was the ability to kind of participate in after school activities when she was in grade school. But the key thing is that, you know, in the space of her growing up in Douglas, Arizona, Douglas becomes one of the most heavily policed small towns in the United States because of Border Patrol strategy that has essentially channeled a continent's worth of migration right into the deserts of southern Arizona, the most dangerous territory on the border. To the point where, you know, by I think 2014 or so, 1 in 7 employed adult men in Douglas worked for law enforcement, right? So this becomes a homeland security company town. It's hyper-policed, it's over-policed, and it's the kind of place where, you know, just the small, everyday kind of dumb mistakes one makes growing up, like any teenager anywhere makes, are gonna have a huge price. And whether that's, you know, something like arguing with your boyfriend's ex on the street, which in this case ends up setting in motion, you know, a stupid little argument with a boyfriend's ex sets in motion a really catastrophic string of events. How do you navigate that world in which every mistake is every choice is so high stakes?
The book really grapples with, you know, with a lot of trauma. Ada is, she's the victim of violence. In at least one case, she's the perpetrator of it as well. And so how did you handle giving your readers a character that wasn't, you know, I think there's this hunger in, you know, especially among white readers for an immigration character who has a clean story, who has a sort of happy ending. You know, you talk in the book about the need for the perfect person, the perfect candidate. How did you handle navigating that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that was really important to me from the very start, that this was not going to be a book about a demon or a saint, but that it was going to talk about a messy, ordinary, brilliant, kind of flawed human life. And it's really hard to overestimate how much of our immigration debates in the United States, even our sense of the United States as a nation of immigrants, how much that turns on this impossible binary between, you know, on one hand, the kind of quote unquote innocent, high achieving, perfect, flawless, good immigrant who maybe deserves sympathies and rights. And then on the other hand, the quote unquote bad criminal alien who deserves all the punishment she gets. And so much of our immigration conversation turns on kind of pitting those two characters against each other. And it's for immigrant rights movements that I've been part of, it's a major struggle as well, because you know that you can win rights for a select group of people by playing to that external idea of the good immigrant, right? This is the Harvard valedictorian neuroscientist undocumented person. But most people, their lives do not fit into that neat, clear binary between the quote-unquote good immigrant and bad immigrant. So I wanted to write a book that expanded the boundaries of empathy to think about the ways in which folks who don't fit that perfect, innocent, high-achieving stereotype of the good immigrant are also fully members of their communities, active makers of their communities, and belong here in their communities. And so that was a crucial piece of the story, or a crucial piece of the project. And I think the politics of the project is very much about trying to do away with that impossible binary. And that in many ways, it's not something that I came up with. You know, that's following the lead of particularly young immigrant organizers who have really stood up to reject that impossible good immigrant, bad immigrant binary and try to build a movement that is about belonging for a much broader spectrum of people.
Yeah, that's a very fine line to walk as a writer, you know, to not clean it up, to not present something that is not the true story. And you mentioned at the end of the book that you and Aida worked very carefully, you know, worked very closely together to craft this narrative. Were there times when she resisted your probing? Were there times when you wanted more than she would give, you know, or vice versa?
I mean, one of the big commitments I made at the beginning was that that Aida would read drafts of the manuscript and that she would get, you know, be commenting on it and shaping the narrative. And that if she ever, you know, in the heat of an interview said something that later she realized, oh, I didn't want to share that, that I would just take that out. And in the end, there wasn't anything like that. And I can't express how courageous Aida is about putting her life out there and really seeing the power of a life that's real, and how a life that's real and flawed, but yet heroic as she is, can move and transform people. And in the end, I think it's far more powerful than if it had been a kind of cleaned up, good, perfect immigrant story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This isn't the first time that you've written about border issues. So did writing this book make you reconsider anything that you about your previous work? Did it make you see anything in a different light?
I mean, I think again the importance of breaking out of that good immigrant, bad immigrant binary was really reinforced by this story. And all the people I met really understood the damage that does, right? I think about like talking with kids who have DACA, right? Who in some ways fit the vision of the good immigrant. Also understand that like by playing the good immigrant, bad immigrant, right? You know, we're not criminals, they're criminals. Well, their criminal is often their parents, right? So that the good immigrant discourse ends up throwing, you know, in this case, their parents under the bus. So a lot of people rejecting that and just kind of seeing the importance of that really come centered. Really also just, this is something I knew before, but really hit home how important it is to think about the borderlands as this rich, important site with its own history and culture that really transcends the drama of immigration and cartels and smuggling that is why we see the borderlands in the news today. And a lot of reporting on the border treats the borderlands just as kind of a backdrop for that drama of immigration and cat and mouse border patrol chases and smuggling and things like that. But really diving into the history and the kind of what matters to folks on the border. And I think ultimately that was crucial because I don't think I would have understood how people in a town like, say, Douglas responded to the steady militarization of their community over 30 years without understanding some of that, the earlier history, for example, of the kind of the deindustrialization of their community during Reagan era anti-union campaigns that really left the small town economically depressed in a similar way of like, you know, a downstate Illinois community that has lost its, you know, washing machine factory. In that way, Douglas isn't that different from many other places in the country, even though it has this unique border location. So really trying to understand that.
So that the dynamics were similar. You know, I was struck by that, you know, the rhetoric used to divide the town, that really came on the heels of, you know, this economic depression that affected everyone, somehow wound up being blamed on only the Mexican migrant workers. And I thought that was so, that was, you know, this, you're talking about, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, how different is it than the rhetoric that we're hearing today?
Right. I mean, and the rhetoric today on the national scale is also different from the rhetoric in a border community, you know, like Douglas, which is 85% Mexican American. And you see many divides. You know, I think, again, trying to not stereotype the border, once you get up close, you see that, right, you know, most of the Border Patrol agents in Douglas are Mexican American. You know, the mayor, who's a kind of character in the book, who's very anti-immigrant, pro-immigration restriction, is Mexican-American, right? So thinking about the ways in which this community is divided as well, and a big part of that has to do with the fact that a vast border security industrial complex has been created such that, you know, a town like Douglas depends on security spending for to keep restaurants going, to, you know, the city budget. You know, the Douglas High School Mexican-American kid who graduates and looks out at her town and sees the Border Patrol is kind of the only job in town that has good benefits and a, you know, a sense of purpose. So really understanding the way that that border military industrial complex has transformed communities.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, it really, you know, struck me while I was reading the effect on everyone. Yeah. In town that this has had, and that in telling the full and complete story, you're not finding the stereotypes, you're finding a lot of human beings who are trying to live their lives and trying to figure out how to do them, you know, the best. Ida most of all.
Yeah.
Is there more room for that now, do you think, with increased focus on the border, or has that regressed? Are we looking for easier things?
That's an excellent question. I mean, I think the terrain has shifted for sure. I think right now, you know, something that wasn't really on the radar when I began writing is the mass exodus of Central Americans fleeing the kind of the U.S. sponsored drug war in Central America. And the way that that has become the next big crisis on the border. I think when we say border crisis in that context, it's a little bit of a misnomer, right? Because what we have is a crisis in Central America that then we're making much worse with our current policies on the U.S.-Mexico border. But I think, you know, that is not something that I was grappling with. And I do think that has changed the way we're thinking about border crises at this moment. So I think there's some interesting space for complexity in thinking about asylum seekers coming from Central America right now. Whereas my book is primarily about undocumented folks who are who are coming from Mexico for the most part, and kind of blurring the different shades, which are artificial to begin with, between asylum seeker and economic refugee.
So, you know, you came to this story, you know, having done work in this area before, but you also came to it as a white man.
Yeah.
Were you concerned about the question of cultural appropriation, of somehow trying to give a voice to something that had already been told in its own voice? And how did you negotiate your responsibility as a writer alongside that identity?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is something that, I thought about this all the time throughout the process of the project. This is the thing that kept me up at night through the project, and still kind of, I'm still learning and trying to figure this out. Because as you say, you know, I knew coming in as a straight white man, that there were all kinds of ways in which I could, you know, misunderstand, misrepresent, the stories I was hearing, appropriate them for other purposes. And I actually struggled a long time about whether it was even possible to write a book like this ethically from my position. And a lot of back and forth with Ida. Ida was very committed to the project through the whole thing. And, you know, she would say things like, you know, Aaron, I have already dealt with the worst possible people you can imagine. You know, this project is something that can be part of my healing and a way to make a difference in the world. So I did feel like there was something really important and a reason to tell the story. And so how do you then navigate all those potential pitfalls? And, you know, it's not for me to say whether I did it well, but what I set out to do was, first of all, that I wasn't just kind of parachuting in, right? I had had a long experience in Mexico and on the border and working in immigrant rights advocacy. It's something that I've been connected to and care a lot about and doing the research. The second is making it as collaborative a process as possible, which is that, you know, Ida would be reading drafts throughout the project and shaping the narrative, and we would be talking about key aspects of the book together, and that extended to her family, friends, and other people who appear in the book. And then trying to make it community-based, right? Really drawing on the connections I have on the border, people who are in border activist organizations, border community leaders, border community groups, to get their pushback and feedback throughout the whole process. And then really just throughout the whole project, engaging with scholars and activists of color, particularly women, who can understand, yeah, the benefits of a project like this, but also the risks of a project like this at a really immediate level. And it was the feedback and the critique and really the encouragement that came out of that process that made me think, like, okay, yes, we can go through with this. And one of the first questions I would ask folks often was simply like, should I publish this? fully expecting to hear the answer no. And it was the kind of encouragement that came out of that that moved the project forward. For me. So again, I mean, I feel like I'm still learning these about how to handle questions of representation and the kind of ethical pitfalls of this project. But, you know, that's kind of how I tried to navigate it well.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, you know, asking activists, particularly women and women of color, what the risks were in a project like this. What did they tell you?
Yeah, I mean, so there's levels of risk, right? I mean, there were the possibility of a kind of re-traumatizing in the storytelling. Ida talked with her therapist throughout the project about the idea and kind of came to the conclusion that telling the story was healing. But there is the risk of re-traumatization. There's the risk of kind of exposing Ida to, you know, the awfulness of the internet, for example, and kind of hateful folks. And that's, you know, in the end, we went back and forth for a long time about the use of pseudonyms and ended up with pseudonyms primarily for the privacy of her family. And then there's kind of luckily Ida and her family are in a good position now in terms of their documentation status. So that was less of a concern. And then there's a risk of kind of reinforcing kind of negative stereotypes or doing harm through the kinds of, you know, we've definitely seen books about the border that reinforce certain kinds of stereotypes of the border as this kind of essentially violent place full of these kind of crazed macho men. I had at one point in the process a reader associated with publishing, not my editor. My editor was fantastic, but said something like, Aaron, can't you make Agua Prieta seem more sinister, more like the Sicario movies? So kind of really like having to work against a lot of the stereotypes that treat the border as this kind of essentially violent kind of one thing that I worked with a lot with kind of scholars and activists of color was the, like, how do you write a story in which some pretty violent and awful men do some pretty horrible violence in this book, and doing justice to that without like reinforcing stereotypes that like Latino men are that way, which are kind of the dominant ways in which our culture understands, say, violence on the border or Latino intra-family violence. Trying to kind of write the violence that was real to the experience of violence, but also putting it in a larger political and historical context to see that, like, if the border is a violent place right now, in large part, that's because of direct policy choices by the US and Mexican government. It's not about a kind of a central culture of the border. So trying to draw out that history and that politics was crucial to being able to situate the violence in the story.
You did a Q&A with Nate King, who runs our blog, and one of your, you mentioned during that Q&A, which is on our website at AmericanWritersMuseum.org, for those of you that are following along with that. You mentioned just how long those stereotypes have been with us.
Yeah.
And I found, can you talk a little bit about that in your historical research? You found some of the same stereotypes going, back 100 years.
Oh yeah, I remember reading dispatches from journalists writing about the border around 1916, and they're using very similar tropes to that you see in Netflix series about the border and also serious journalism about the border sometimes. Mm-hmm. The vacant-eyed refugee child was a trope in that 1916 writing. The wily border bandit, the savvy cross-cultural worker who can slip across both sides of the border and cultures with ease, the fixer, as it were, the lazy cantina that has deep secrets. And I think in that Q&A, I said something like, the border sometimes comes across like the bar scene in Star Wars.
That characterization has been around that long.
Yeah. And part of that is just trying to, how do you do justice in writing about this place to the fact that it is a really unusual and unique place where people are living their lives across all kinds of borders. And they're living their lives across language and across culture. There's, all kinds of like physical relocations where, people are moving from one side to the other. And so lives are complicated and interesting in this space. But you don't have to then kind of exotify it.
Yeah. Yeah. What has been the reception of folks in Douglas and of people who are mentioned in the book? What has been the reception to the book? Have they felt that you've done it justice?
So yeah, early on soon after the book came out in hardback, I had a series of book events. I did a book event in Bisbee, which is a town about 30 minutes from Douglas, just off the border in Arizona. I did an event in Douglas, Arizona, and I did an event in Agua Prieta, Sonora, on the other side of the border from Douglas. And I was terrified. You cannot imagine how terrified I was to take the book back to these contexts. When has it ever gone well that, like, the writer, journalist person came back to the small town he or she wrote about and, like, people loved it? So I was pretty terrified going in. But what I found was that it was just moving how people received the book, where, like, the question and answer period, a good chunk of the question and answer period was people standing up and talking about how they feel like their town is never portrayed as a real place. It's just a backdrop for all this other stuff, you know, Fox News stuff. And that for the first time, they felt like the history and the and life, everyday life in their town had been portrayed in a real way. And that was, you know, anything else that happened with the book, you know, that was enough. You know, that was just such a profound experience. And then individuals affected by the book as well. I mentioned Rosy Mendoza, who I've always thought of as kind of a hero, and she's this badass. And yet she wrote me a text early on after she read the final book, where she said, you know, like, sometimes I doubt myself and my work, and, like, being able to see myself through this book reminds me of how what I'm doing matters, and it allows my kids for the first time to really see what I do. So that kind of stuff. Another moment with Ida wrote about how very confidently she said, you know, I always knew that the book was going to make a difference in the world. but what I hadn't known was how much of an impact it would make on my own life. And knowing that people, you know, I've been sharing lots of emails from readers who are talking about what a hero she is, and kind of how that has, being able to see herself through readers' eyes has really given her confidence and abilities and a sense of healing is, I mean, it's just, it floored me. And it's, you know, I think it's the most important thing that's come out of the book. Yeah, so I've just been really moved and blown away by the kinds of reactions. Or, you know, yesterday I got an email from a professor friend of mine. It was a forwarded email from a student of his who's undocumented, young undocumented woman, and they had read the book in their class. And she said, you know, I felt like it was about my own family, and I was seeing my own family as a hero in this story. And so, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
That feels really good.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for being with us tonight to share this project.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you all for attending.
All right, everybody, have a good night, and we'll see you at our next program. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Tune in next week as we continue our Immigrant Heritage Month celebrations with historian Dominic A. Pasiga, who chronicles the history of Polish immigration to Chicago in his book American Warsaw. Pasiga is interviewed by Sarah Paretsky. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.